Man, we gotta start using Apple Cash.
Okay, why?
It's so easy and convenient. Apple Cash lives in messages.
All right.
So I can pay you in the convos we're already having, not forget a payment, or have money sitting somewhere just collecting dust.
Oh, that is nice.
And then you can use that cash right away and buy stuff, like at a store, with Apple Pay.
I don't have to do all that bank transfer stuff?
Nope. It's just right there. Easy, convenient, and secure.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
See how easy that was? Services are provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Terms apply.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
It is time for our next installment of Unearthed. If you're new to the show, this is when we talk about things that have been literally or figuratively unearthed over the last 3 months. In part one of this two-part installment of Unearthed, we have some oldest things, some books and letters, a couple of projects that are specifically related to gender in some way, edibles and potables, and animals. And then on Wednesday, we will have some other stuff, including some finds that seemed particularly suited to this being October and the lead up to Halloween. As usual in these episodes, we will kick it off with some updates to things we have talked about on the show before.
So back in 2014, we did an episode on the embalming and mummification rituals of ancient Egypt. And in August, a team of researchers from Max Planck Institute of Geoanthropology announced that they had recreated a scent that came from this process around 1450 BCE. They analyzed residues from canopic jars, finding that, as expected, they contained beeswax, plant oils, fats, various tree resins, and a balsamic substance. They used these findings to formulate what they describe as the scent of eternity, which is planned to be used as an additional sensory element at an upcoming exhibition at the Mosgaard Museum in Denmark. I sure hope they also make a strange perfume out of it.
That does sound like it could be like a nice earthy
kind of soothing kind scent.
Yeah. So next, an inventory of the art collection of King Charles I has led to the rediscovery of one of Artemisia Gentileschi's works, that is Susanna and the Elders, which was commissioned by Queen Henrietta Maria. To be clear, this is not the same Susanna and the Elders that's generally recognized as her earliest signed work. That painting was created in 1610. Gentileschi painted several different versions of this scene, and this specific one dates to the 1630s.
This painting had been wrongly attributed to the French school in an inventory at least a century ago, and it had also darkened over time, making parts of the picture almost impossible to see. Since its rediscovery, it has been through conservation and study, and it is now on display at the Queen's Drawing Room in Windsor Castle.
Our episode on Artemisia Gentileschi was most recently a Saturday classic on May 6th of this year.
In September of 2020, we did a Six Impossible episodes called There's a Book About That, in which we talked about some topics that were tricky to cover on this show because so much research would have to come from one specific book on the subject. And one of those books was The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, written by Rebecca Skloot. And it is about Henrietta Lacks, whose cancer cells were collected without her consent while she was a patient at Johns Hopkins in 1951. Those cells became the immortalized cell line known as HeLa, which has been used in medical research and pharmaceutical development, with some companies profiting off of their products and discoveries that came directly from their work with those cells.
Earlier this year, members of Lacks' family reached a settlement with biotechnology company Thermo Fisher Scientific, which was one of the companies that made use of Lacks' cells in their work. The family's attorneys held a news conference on August 1st, which was Lacks' birthday, and they issued a statement which read, quote, members of the family of Henrietta Lacks and Thermo Fisher have agreed to settle the litigation filed by Henrietta Lacks' estate in the U.S. District Court in Baltimore. The terms of the agreement will be confidential. The parties are pleased that they were able to find a way to resolve this matter outside of court and will have no further comment about the settlement.
In one of our 2021 installments of Unearthed, we talked about research confirming that the Tsleil-Waututh Nation had sustainably harvested salmon in the Pacific Northwest for at least 1,000 years. A paper published in the journal PLOS ONE in August builds on that research. While the earlier study documented sustainable fishing for chum salmon from 400 BC to 1200 CE, this study confirms that the same practices were in use both before and after that period, from 850 BCE to 1650 CE. Chum salmon are susceptible to overfishing, but this research suggests that they were abundant in this part of what's now British Columbia for that entire time, meaning that the harvesting practices being used helped support a healthy population of the fish.
In the latest news on the natural mummy known as Ötzi, research into his DNA suggests that he was descended from people from Anatolia in what's now Turkey. And that really seems to be most of his ancestry, suggesting that most of the people in the area where he was from were all descended from Anatolian farmers, and that this community was isolated from other communities that might have had other genetic ancestry. This research also suggests that he had dark eyes and darker skin than he's generally been depicted with, and also that he may have been going bald.
Ötzi's genome has been sequenced before this, back in 2012, but the more recent work has used more advanced methods than were available then. This was published in the journal Cell Genomics under the title High Coverage Genome of the Tyrolean Iceman Reveals Unusually High Anatolian Farmer Ancestry.
We've had a lot of Ötzi updates on this show, and prior hosts covered him in a full episode in January of 2012 in an episode they titled Ötzi, Everyone's Favorite Copper Age Man.
In July of 2014, we did an episode that looked at cosmetics history around the world, and we've got a find related to that. Archaeologists working at the Roman-era city of Izanoi in Turkey have unearthed an entire cosmetics shop. This shop dates back at least 2,000 years, and they found a makeup palette and tools, jewelry, and hair accessories. The cosmetics included makeup pigments that may have been used as blush or eyeshadow, and the most common colors were red and pink. They also found lots of oyster shells, which were often used as holders for cosmetic pigments in the Roman era.
Next, in our July 2020 Unearthed, we talked about research involving Amazon dark earth, which are areas of dark, particularly fertile soil in the Amazon. That research compared plant life that was growing in dark earth to plant life growing outside of it, found that areas in the dark earth had richer plant diversity, a higher pH, and more nutrients in the soil. In that earlier installment of Unearthed, we described this dark earth as having been created by the region's early inhabitants who used substances like charcoal and food waste to enrich the soil.
That made it kind of surprising to read headlines from September of this year, which were along the lines of ancient Amazonians intentionally created fertile dark earth. Apparently, there's been some debate about whether Amazon dark earth was intentionally created or was an accidental byproduct of the day-to-day activities of the ancient peoples who lived in the area.
Well, according to research published in the journal Science Advances, The creation of Amazon Dark Earth was indeed intentional. This research combined soil analysis, prior ethnographic observations, and interviews with and observations of people in modern indigenous communities. Much of the fieldwork for this took place in the Kwikuru Indigenous Territory, which is home to both Kwikuru ancestral sites and modern Kwikuru villages.
In both modern practices and in the archaeological record, dark earth occurs in a pattern that is a bit like spokes on a wheel, with the dark earth focused on a central point and then radiating outward. Modern and ancient samples of dark earth also had a similar chemical composition. So the researchers concluded that, as we sort of took for granted in that discussion back in 2020, early inhabitants of the Amazon had intentionally worked things like food scraps, charcoal, and waste into the soil, creating this carbon-rich, fertile dark earth, which has remained over the course of hundreds or thousands of years.
When I saw these articles about this, I was like, wait, was this a question? I did not realize it might have been. Moving on. The third excavation in the search for victims of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre started in September. Earlier searches have found the remains of 66 people. We talked about the genealogical research into the identities of some of those people in our Summer Unearthed this year. This set of excavations ended on September 29th with 59 graves found and 7 sets of remains exhumed. All but 2 of the graves found in this excavation were unmarked and previously unknown.
The 7 sets of remains that were exhumed were all in simple wooden boxes, which is what investigators had been looking for based on descriptions in news reports from the time of the massacre. The plan is to conduct forensic analysis on these remains and collect DNA samples if possible, and then to bury them in the place they were exhumed from.
Viola Ford Fletcher, who survived the massacre, also wrote a book on it with her grandson, Ike Howard. This book is called Don't Let Them Bury My Story, The Oldest Living Survivor of the Tulsa Race Massacre in Her Own Words, and it was published in August.
And in our last update, in July, Hartwig Fisher, director of the British Museum, announced that he would be stepping down in 2024, but then he resigned in August. And that resignation came days after the museum announced that about 2,000 objects had been stolen from its collection. Peter Higgs, a curator who had worked there for 30 years, was fired after allegedly selling items from the collection on eBay. Apparently, Fisher and others at the museum had been warned about the thefts in 2021, but had not taken action. The museum launched a section of its website dedicated to trying to find and recover the stolen items in September.
This was obviously appalling. It is most relevant to show updates because it means someone else will have to take up the question of the Parthenon marbles, which we covered in a 2-parter in January of 2020. And now we will take a quick sponsor break before we talk about some oldest things. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian, someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
We have several finds that are being described as the oldest, or maybe as one of the oldest. First, on Kodiak Island, Alaska, archaeologists from the Aleutic Museum and Archaeological Repository have unearthed some woven grass mats that are believed to be 3,000 years old. This makes them the oldest well-documented examples of Kodiak Aleutic Supiak weaving. They were found in the remains of a sod house that had burned and collapsed. And pieces of charred woven material were found under what was left of the walls of this sod house. These are believed to have been grass mats used for sleeping.
It's likely that the practice of weaving is thousands of years older than these specific examples. But because these woven pieces were made from grass and other plant materials, it's rare to find intact examples in the archaeological record. These only survived because they had been protected by the remains of the burned building.
Next, we have what may be the oldest baskets in southern Europe. These were part of a collection of objects found in a cave in Spain in the 19th century, but recent carbon-14 dating has shown that these date to between 9,500 and 6,200 years ago. The baskets are on the older end of that timeline, and this is the first direct evidence of Mesolithic hunter-gatherer peoples making baskets. Like, we already knew that people were making baskets after that, but not quite this early. Other objects that were also part of this collection included sandals and tools. And the sandals, which are made of grass, are also among the oldest. They're roughly 6,200 years old, and they may be the oldest sandals ever found.
Researchers in Albania believe that they have found the oldest stilt villages in Europe. This is on the Albanian side of Lake Ohrid, and the village dates back to between 6,000 and 5,800 BCE. That's several hundred years older than other known stilt villages. This village seems to have been very heavily fortified. Divers found tens of thousands of spikes that were likely used for defensive purposes, but it's not clear why the people who lived at this village felt that they needed to do that. Like, logically, there was obviously some kind of perceived threat, but we do not know exactly what that threat was.
So if this sounded a little familiar, this is at the same lake, but it's a different stilt village than we talked about on Unearthed in 2021. That one was on the Macedonian side of Lake Ohrid, and this one was on the Albanian side.
So many stilt villages. Researchers in Zambia have found what may be the world's oldest wooden structure, one that dates back 476,000 years before the appearance of modern humans. This structure is made of a pair of logs with interconnecting notches, so sort of like Lincoln Logs, and it may have been part of the foundation for a building.
So this is a more complex use of wood and building than has previously been documented from this time period. A lot of the researchers who were interviewed about it expressed some surprise that pre-Homo sapiens were able to construct something like this. These logs probably survived for as long as they did because they were submerged in water. So it's possible that this was not actually unusual, that other people were building similar Lincoln log-like structures, but like other examples of this have not survived until today.
In our last oldest thing, archaeologists from the Phanagoria Archaeological Expedition have discovered one of the oldest known synagogues. Phanagoria was an ancient Greek city located on the Black Sea in what is now southern Russia. It was founded in the 1st century, so toward the end of the Second Temple period of Jewish history. This was roughly 400 years after the first known synagogues were established, but only about a dozen synagogues are known to have been built during the Second Temple period.
This synagogue was a rectangular structure measuring 21 by 6 meters, that's 69 by 20 feet, and divided into two rooms. Engravings have been discovered that include dates related to the synagogue's founding, along with the word synagogue, and religious imagery, including carvings of sort of menorah-like candle arrangements. There are also fragments of columns decorated with what look like leaves.
So now we're going to move on to some books and letters. Earlier this year, a donor sent some books to West Virginia University libraries and let the curator know that one of them seemed to be a library book. Once she started going through them, the curator discovered that the library book was James Clerk Maxwell's 1881, An Elementary Treatise on Electricity, which had been checked out from the New Bedford Free Public Library in Massachusetts.
So usually when a library removes a book from its collection, it marks it in some way, like stamping it with the word discarded or withdrawn. This book didn't have any kind of marking like that, so it didn't seem like it had been officially removed from the library's collection. But it did still have one of those slips with dates stamped on it to mark when people had checked it out. I don't know if, like, the youngest of our listeners have seen these in library books because they've mostly been replaced by computer systems now. The last stamp was a little unclear, but it had last been checked out on Valentine's Day of either 1904 or 1905. That last digit is just a little bit smudgy.
So the curator got in touch with the New Bedford Free Library and made arrangements to return this extremely overdue book, which is still in very good condition. The library received the book in late June, but news coverage about it didn't really start until early July.
Stories on long overdue library books often talk about how much the fine would be if the library were to try to collect it. The New Bedford Free Library has capped its fines for overdue books at $2.
This is not a Futurama moment where they go, that book is now going to cost you $1,027,000. Yeah. Next, beginning in 1615, William Camden published Annals, or the History of the Most Renowned and Victorious Princess Elizabeth, late Queen of England, containing all the important and remarkable passages of state, both at home and abroad, during her long and prosperous reign. And that was in Latin. This was published in two parts, and it was the first official chronicle of Elizabeth's time on the throne. And Camden likely worked with other collaborators while creating it. Now, researchers have used a range of imaging techniques to look at handwritten manuscripts of this book so that they could study Camden's writing process, including things that he struck out or pasted over or rewrote as he was writing it. Within the 10 volumes of handwritten manuscripts, hundreds of pages were physically covered over, with the replacement pages adhered so tightly that they could not be removed to examine what was underneath without damaging the originals.
William Cecil Lord Burghley had asked Camden to write the annals while Elizabeth was still living, but Lord Burghley died in 1598, and then Elizabeth died in 1603 and was succeeded by James VI of Scotland. That meant that James became the person that Camden had to satisfy in terms of what he had written. And some of this new research, using imaging techniques to see what was under those pasted over pages, it's revealed that a lot of the changes generally made James look better than he might have looked otherwise.
For example, one of Camden's revisions was the addition of Elizabeth naming James as her successor on her deathbed. James was widely regarded as her logical successor since he was the son of Elizabeth's cousin and rival, Mary, Queen of Scots. But having Elizabeth specifically name him gave it all some additional weight. There's no other historical evidence for this happening, though, and other accounts describe Elizabeth as too ill to speak on her deathbed. So this seems like the kind of thing that Camden might have added in to please the king.
Until now, Camden's work has been viewed as, overall, an impartial and accurate account of the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. Although, in his own intro, he did write, quote, "Things doubtful I have interpreted favorably, things secret and abstruse I have not pried into." But this new research suggests that James might have had a bigger influence on Camden's work than was really previously known. It's possible or even likely that James didn't ask for any of these changes directly, but that Camden was kind of censoring himself out of fear of displeasing the king. It is still to be seen whether this will lead to any new interpretations of Queen Elizabeth I.
Moving on, a framed sketch of Winnie the Pooh and Piglet walking into the sunset by illustrator E.H. Shepherd was found in a cellar drawer wrapped in a tea towel. This sketch is dated 1958, so more than 30 years after his original Winnie the Pooh illustrations were published. But since it is his original work and not a copy, it sold at auction for £27,000.
This illustration had belonged to Christopher Foyle, co-founder of Foyle's Bookshop, and was found by his widow, Kathy. This may have been drawn at one of a series of events called Foyle's Literary Lunches that were hosted by Christopher's Aunt Christina. Frequently, there would be famous literary guests at these lunches. I just love the idea of a Winnie the Pooh picture being found in a tea towel.
Yes, there's something so sweet and perfect about it. And lastly, sort of book adjacent, an auction appraiser found a suffragist game called Panko, Suffragists versus Anti-Suffragists, in a cupboard during a home clearance. Panko is named for Emmeline Pankhurst and was a game for 4, 6, or 8 players. It's a card game with suffragist suits in mauve and green and anti-suffragist suits in red and black. Players tried to collect full suits of 6 cards, and once they did, they had to call out the words that went along with that suit. Like, the call for one of the suffragist suits was "Votes for Women," and one of the anti-suffragist suits was "Jail, jail, jail."
It seems like it might have been a very raucous game in some circles. These cards were illustrated by political cartoonist Edward Tennyson Reed, and they featured well-known people from the suffrage and anti-suffrage movements. It was distributed by the Women's Social and Political Union, which sold copies of this game for 2 shillings apiece. This copy of the game sold at auction for £320 in August, and it is not the only copy of this game that is still around. A search to confirm how much it sold for at auction brought up a number of other auction listings of other copies of the game from the last 5 or 6 years.
I feel like if they made a commercially available copy of this deck, mm-hmm. it would sell like hotcakes.
Yeah, I think I saw some PDFs of like all the card faces, so it might be possible to like print your own. However, we will take a break for another moment and we'll come back with some more findings. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian, someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Next up, we have a couple of papers that are related to sex or gender in some way. First, a paper called Sex-Based Parental Investment and Female Wealth Accumulation in Ancient California was published in the American Journal of Biological Anthropology in July. This was a collaboration involving the Muwekma Ohlone tribe and researchers from universities in Utah and California. Researchers used different types of isotopes to explore how and where Ohlone ancestors lived as long as 2,000 years ago.
This research suggests that girls were breastfed for longer than boys. The team drew this conclusion by looking at isotopes in tooth enamel, which suggested that girls were weaned at the age of about 3 years, while boys were weaned at the age of about 2.6 years. After being weaned, children's diets seemed to be the same, regardless of their sex. The team also used isotope research to determine where people who were buried at a site in what is now the city of Santa Clara had come from. And those isotopes suggested that the women were local to the area, but the men were not.
Together, this supports the idea that this was a matrilineal society, one in which women stayed in the village where they had been born while their male partners moved into that area from somewhere else. The burials at the site also suggest that women were generally more wealthy than men were because older women were usually buried with more wealth. These conclusions are based on a small number of burials, though. There were 24 sets of remains that were discovered at this burial site. 22 of them were part of this study.
Next, new research has been published in the journal Scientific Reports under the title Atlatl Use Equalizes Female and Male Projectile Weapon Velocity. Thrown spears and javelins have been around a lot longer than atlatls have, and one hypothesis is that people started using atlatls because it made it easier for people with a range of experience and ability to have roughly the same success as hunters. Described in the press release about this research as the, quote, atlatl equalizer hypothesis.
So, in working on Unearthed, I've been developing a fondness for the studies that involve getting living people to try to do something to see if it gives us a sense of how ancient people might have done it. So this time, researchers had 108 people, all of them novices, a lot of them students from Kent State, use both javelins and atlatls. And they found that using an atlatl increased the velocity of the projectile. And it also meant that the projectile's velocity was about the same, regardless of the gender of the person who was using the atlatl.
Of course, this doesn't prove anything one way or the other about whether ancient people's use of the atlatl varied according to gender. But it does suggest the possibility that women could have been hunters, and even that women may have been instrumental in the development of the atlatl, since it would have generally provided them with a bigger jump in performance. It also suggests that burials that include atlatls and other hunting tools might be interpreted similarly regardless of the sex of the person buried there.
Yeah, this is sort of an argument against the idea that if a man's body is buried with hunting tools, he must have been a hunter. But if a woman's body is buried with hunting tools, that must have been symbolic. Now to move on, we have some edibles and potables. And the first one could also have gone into the section on the oldest things. Archaeologists have found the earliest evidence of curry in Southeast Asia. And by curry, we mean the types of spices that are used in the dishes that Westerners often describe as curry. That is a really, really broad term that was coined by European colonists to describe all kinds of dishes that are usually served in a spice-based sauce.
In this case, archaeologists were working in southern Vietnam and found spices on stone tools used for pounding and grinding. Those spices included turmeric, ginger, finger root, sand ginger, galangal, clove, nutmeg, and cinnamon. These spices would have been brought to Vietnam from what's now India, Sri Lanka, and parts of Indonesia.
So this finding suggests that people in what's now southern Vietnam were using these spices, probably in food, as long as 2,000 years ago. And also that there was a maritime spice trade network spanning thousands of miles to get all of these spices to places where they were being used. It may also suggest some human migration patterns, since presumably people from South Asia brought some of these spices with them to Southeast Asia as they either moved there or visited there.
Another study of grindstones suggests that humans were processing plants into flour long before the development of agriculture, and possibly much earlier than scientists previously thought. These grindstones dated back to 39,000 to 43,000 years ago, when humans and Neanderthals were coexisting in parts of the world. One of the pestles examined may have been used by Neanderthals, suggesting that they may have known these food processing techniques as well.
Yet another finding of Neanderthals doing cool and interesting things that suggest they're smarter than they've long been given credit for. Next, a man digging a backyard swimming pool in Stirling, Scotland, found a set of dolphin bones and a tool that was probably used to carve the dolphin's meat. These finds date back roughly 8,000 years, and researchers have speculated that the dolphin washed ashore and that then local people butchered it for food. The tool that was used was made from deer antler, and it appears that its tip broke off as it was being used.
And for our last food find, we have talked about various conclusions drawn from the residue in vessels used to cook and store food. This time, research on metal cauldrons dating back to between 3700 and 2900 BCE suggests that people in the Caucasus were eating meat from deer, sheep, goats, and members of the cow family. That's not all that surprising, but this research also suggests that people were making feasts to feed large numbers of people at once. And this is really the earliest known example of people preparing a large feast for lots of people rather than a meal for a family or a smaller group.
Now we will move on to a few animal finds to wrap up this episode. Archaeologists at Wittenham Clumps in Oxfordshire have found the remains of a small dog that dates back about 1800 years. This dog was probably owned by a wealthy Roman family. The dog measured only about 20 centimeters or a little less than 8 inches tall and had slightly bowed legs. A sketch of what the dog might have looked like kind of resembles a Dachshund to me. It's got that long body and short legs.
Dachshunds were originally bred as hunting dogs, and their long, narrow bodies were particularly good at getting into burrowing animals' tunnels. And this site was a farm, which was probably home to hunting and to other working dogs. But in news articles about this find, archaeologists have said they believe this may have been someone's pet. By this point, small dogs were definitely being kept as pets in some parts of the Roman Empire.
Next, the tomb of Western Han Dynasty Emperor Wen has been found to contain a whole menagerie of animals, and some of them are particularly notable. There are tigers, buffalo, oryxes, yaks, peafowl, and monkeys, among others. There's a complete tapir skeleton, which was identified using its teeth and is the first complete tapir skeleton found at a Chinese archaeological site. There is also a complete skeleton of a giant panda, and that's the first giant panda to be found in a Western Han Emperor's mausoleum.
These animals were found in 23 sacrificial pits in an underground mausoleum that also included all kinds of food, pottery, games, and luxury goods. Basically, an effort to recreate the environment of the imperial palace for after the emperor's death. Some of these animals were probably gifts that came to the palace from other regions, but the presence of the tapir skeleton has raised some questions about whether there may have been tapir in China 2,000 years ago. It was believed that they were extinct in China by that point. Researchers plan to conduct DNA testing to confirm the animal species and to use stable isotope analysis to narrow down where they came from.
Moving on, DNA research has suggested that Spanish and Portuguese colonists may have brought cattle from Africa to the Americas, rather than bringing cattle only from Spain, as was previously thought. Christopher Columbus's second expedition is known to have brought Spanish cattle to the Caribbean in 1493, and then there's documentation of those cattle's offspring and then their offspring and so on being introduced to various Caribbean islands as well as Central and South America. So for a long time, it's been believed that for centuries, all the cattle in the Americas were descended from this one Spanish population.
But new DNA research suggests that cattle were shipped to the Americas from Africa as well. This conclusion came from analysis on bones from archaeological sites dating back to the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. Some of this is a little tricky to puzzle out, since there was ongoing trade, including cattle, between Spain and Northern Africa, meaning that some Spanish cattle may have been interbred with cattle from parts of Africa. But researchers found some DNA that's associated only with cattle from Africa. Researchers concluded that Spanish colonists may have been bringing cattle from West Africa to the Americas by the early 1600s, more than a century earlier than was previously believed.
So the assumption here is that enslaved Africans and African cattle were transported from the same parts of West Africa to the Americas. It was already known that enslaved Africans were a huge part of establishing cattle ranching in the Americas, and this would mean that those early ranchers may have been working with animals from where they lived, animals they were already familiar with how to handle.
Lastly, author Julie Flavelle published a piece in Smithsonian Magazine that relates a pretty tear-jerking story about a Newfoundland dog who served on both sides of the Revolutionary War.
So first, this dog belonged to Continental Army General Richard Montgomery, who was killed at the Battle of Quebec. The dog then guarded Montgomery's body, refusing to let British soldiers near it after the battle was over. And then, according to a 1783 letter by Caroline Howe, the dog tried to dig him out of his grave.
British Major General William Phillips then adopted the dog, naming him Rebel. Both Phillips and Rebel were later taken prisoner by the Continental Army.
So this story goes on from there, but I started to feel like I was just paraphrasing the Smithsonian article. So I encourage folks who are interested to go read it for themselves. It is called The Dog Who Served on Both Sides of the American Revolution, and it's at smithsonian.com. You will have more finds on Wednesday.
Do we have listener mail in the meantime?
We do have listener mail in the meantime. We have listener mail that I have had marked to read for literal months, and for some reason, I didn't read it. And this is from Robin. Robin wrote to us after we had talked about Barbette. And Barbette's an episode that Holly did the research on. But Robin is commenting on something that I said, which is that I was really curious. Like, I don't really know what the vibe in Austin was like when Barbette was living versus its, like, reputation today. So Robin wrote, Holly and Tracy, love the show as always. Thanks for always educating me during my work commutes and during the summer, during my road trips. I'm writing because I listened to the Barbette and Square Dance episodes on the drive up from my dad's, and coincidentally, my mom moved to Austin a year after Barbette passed. In 1974, you had people like Willie Nelson and Asleep at the Wheel coming on the scene. Lots of music and laid-back attitudes. It was the birth of the infamous slogan other people from Texas used to describe Austin. My mom worked at an overnight diner that's since been torn down and let one of the normal patrons borrow her car overnight. And he brought it back in the morning with the entire back of the car filled with cantaloupes. The perfect example of things that happened all the time that inspired Keep Austin Weird. I grew up just south of San Antonio, so I know how to pull a calf, but couldn't square dance to save my life. We did cumbia in school, but they weren't even real dances. It was more like someone had a radio. And when it was too hot for us kids to be outside for PE, they threw us in the carpeted gym that was inside an old Nickelodeon theater from the 19-teens and let us run wild. And it always turned into a cumbia. I moved to Austin for college, and even as a paler-than-pale kid, the culture shock was real. So this sort of goes on to talk about the mix of ethnicities and races and the different neighborhoods simultaneously embracing every type of person in certain places. So this goes on to talk more about some more recent things in Austin, how changes have been made more recently. But since my original question had been about Barbette, I'm going to just move ahead to where Robin says, all this to say, if Barbette had lived just a couple years longer, he could have seen Elton John perform here like my mom did, or see a time where Austin really started to blossom as the land that conservative Texas grew to hate. I also hope I see a day where the amount of money lifelong Texans make will start to match the cost of living that's ballooned since the city has doubled in size. I hope for that also. So this is one of the longer emails that we've gotten, and I'm just going to wrap it up here since the Barbette and Austin vibe part was really my curiosity. Robin also sent some pictures, which this is one of those times where the picture is bigger than my email window. So, yeah, it's just some pictures with a very cute dog.
Puppers.
Always love the very cute dog.
Yes.
So thank you so much, Robin. I'm sorry it took me literal months to read this email that I had flagged to read months ago. I did not really realize that sort of the Keep Austin Weird sentimentality went back quite that far to before I even was born. So thank you. Thank you again for this email. If you would like to send us a note about this or any other podcast, we're at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. We're all over social media. A Mist in History, and you can subscribe to our show on the iHeartRadio app or wherever else you'd like to get your podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Guess what, Will?
What's that, Mango?
I've been trying to write a promo for our podcast, Part-Time Genius, but even though we've done over 250 episodes, we don't really talk about murders or cults.
I mean, we did just cover the Illuminati of cheese, so I feel like that makes us pretty edgy. We also solve mysteries like how Chinese is your Chinese food and how do dollar stores make money? And then, of course, can you game a dog show?
So what you're saying is everyone should be listening.
Listen to Part-Time Genius on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jordan Gonsalves, and I'm a journalist. Join me on my new podcast, But We Loved, where queer elders recount the amazing history they've lived through.
In the middle of Wall Street, they stopped traffic. They were doing a die-in. Healthcare is a right!
Healthcare is a right! And in the process, share little gems of wisdom for the next generation.
The key is to understanding yourself, learning to love and embrace yourself.
You can listen to But We Loved on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.